Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Not By Sight. This is part 2, episode 7 of Faith in the Valley of Racism. If you haven't listened to part 1, I recommend listening to that episode first. In light of the tension we are all living in right now, from the coronavirus threat to protests over racism to political divisions, after all, this is an election year, many of us are overwhelmed by the chaos. Complicating matters even further are the many voices you will hear on all of these issues. Some of us are uniting together, and some of us are being driven further apart. On this podcast, my goal is to unify us, not divide us. There is no political agenda here, only the act of standing up for what is right and true. The stories you will hear from my friends today are their genuine life experiences as Black women of faith living in America. On this episode, we're tackling how to confront racism in our own interpersonal relationships and what the role of the church is in fostering reconciliation between whites and Blacks. My friends also discuss the changes they believe need to be made within the workplace, the education system, and the criminal justice system to weed out racism. Let's welcome back Allie Thomas, a Miami area fashion designer and military wife, and cousins Shirlene Payne and Desiree DeBose, both social workers right outside of New York City. We pick back up with our conversation with what it looks like raising Black children in America today. In an age of racial profiling and police brutality, what are some of the challenges you deal with as you raise your children in our country today? Let's start with you, Desiree.
Well, in my home, I have a 14-year-old son. He's my only son. So I've always wanted a son. I feel like I'm a boy's mother. But I've always had sort of a little fear in the back of my mind because he is a Black male. And that's what the world will see first. But the thing that almost worries me a little more is that because he's a young male, in a Bergen County community. And even though Westwood is a town that has a great educational system, crime is low here, it is not a representation of the rest of the world. And so when I try to explain certain things to him, yes, he's frustrated. Yes, he's angry. But he's also like, well, it's a good thing I live in Westwood. The thing that worries me the most is, I don't want to say unrealistic, but almost like a Pleasantville sort of feel here. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that he has that he doesn't necessarily have to walk around in that fear, not to say that it can't be there, but it's not as much of a threat as it is in other places. But at the same time, as a mother, I'm like, no, son, I need you to be aware that this can happen when you leave this town. It can happen in this town. It can happen when you go to college. It can happen when you're a husband. It can happen any day in time in this world. And while I'm happy that you're at peace right now and you feel safe, as you should feel safe, everyone should feel safe. But safety is not always promised. It's not always guaranteed. And so the fear that I have outside of him experiencing these things is almost the fantasy that it's outside of Westwood. It's never going to be here. And so that worries me because, one, I don't want him to only feel like he has to exist here because here is where it's safe. But at the same time, I don't want him to only think that because he's here, it can't ever happen either.
Allie, what's been your experience as a mother raising kids in the Miami, Florida area?
Okay, it's not that there is a risk of police brutality specifically here. However, there's just always a risk. I feel like a young Black young man is always at risk. And because of it, like, for example, my children go to a school that would be considered quote unquote affluent. In that respect, when, for example, Halloween, this goes back to when my daughter was at that same school and she wanted to go trick-or-treating with the friends. So I'm like, well, I got to go out there and see what this is about. I'm not going to just send you out there trick-or-treating. And then when I got there, the the house that was sort of quote unquote hosting the trick or treat, you know, trick or treaters for the teenagers. The mom was really shady to me, a very wealthy woman who was just kind of looking at me like, what are you doing here? And I just went and I was like, I'm going to sit in my car. You can trick or treat for a little while, but then you're going to get back in the car. Because if anything happens out here, I can't leave you here and trust these people. Because if anything happens, that something goes wrong, you're the only Black one in that group. They're going to look at you. I don't feel comfortable with my kid out with some group of teenagers just enjoying what would what should be a normal teenage life. I don't. And I don't because I don't trust prejudiced people, racist people out there. It doesn't even have to be the police. I don't trust these people out there. So I cut my children are they're in quarantine from that virus. If you really want to look at it. I don't know. Do you guys have your teens? Are they like, do they, I know you guys live in a kind of a bedroom community, but do they get to freely like just hang out?
No, it's the same thing here. I mean, we have to literally train our children how to behave, how to act in the community, how to act when you're at the friend's home. And if who's there, who's going to be there. And if I don't know this, like all the kids that are there, like, then I need to speak to at least the parent where you're, who's hosting, because I need to get a feel how they interact and like, you know, how they parent. And so, yeah, we have to go through the motions here too. I mean, there's been one particular friend of my 17-year-old daughter. At the time she was about 15, and her friend moved from, she's biracial and she's half Spanish and half, she's half Spanish and half white. She moved here from the Bronx, from New York, and then she stayed with her aunt and uncle who were very racist. And I would say to her, like, no, you can't go there because I don't think that they will protect you if anything happened. I believe that you would be the scapegoat. You would be thrown under the bus and then maybe even your life. And I have girls. I don't have boys, but the pressure is still there. The danger is still there. You know,
how are your kids handling what's going on right now, especially after seeing the video of George Floyd's killing? And tell me, what are the types of conversations that you're having in your homes?
Well, for my son, we've been having conversations because he has had several racial incidents at school. So, you know, he's been around kids who have used the N-word freely, or he has been called the N-word. So his racial encounters started, you know, at a young age as well. And so I've been, when these things have been happening with him, he expressed a lot of anger, a lot of rage. And, you know, his emotional reaction was like, I want to just fight everybody, you know, let me hurry up and go to another school, you know, just forget it. But, you know, what I taught my son and what I was taught, what Shirley and I both were taught, was how to advocate. You know, I taught him how to advocate, and because I wanted him to feel that he could stand up for himself. And I told him, and I tell him even to this day, there is a way you speak, but you make sure you speak with authority and be careful not to speak with just emotion. Have your facts, have everything you need to say, give dates and times, and address it immediately. You know, you don't wait, you address it immediately. So with everything that's going on now, what he was most upset about after seeing the video is he felt, how come nobody helped this man? And, you know, him and a couple of his other friends even said, I would have been prepared to die. I wouldn't have just let this man, you know, die like that. I would have thrown a rock or a shoe, and, you know, and that's their underdeveloped brains. But at the same time, I commended him that he felt so strongly that he would be willing to, in his mind, give his life. Obviously, we don't know what they would do given if they were present, But, you know, he has that heart to say, we still have to represent for each other, even though there's so much anger and so much rage over it. And he has a hard time, you know, connecting. And, you know, sometimes he'll go to the extreme and say, I hate all cops. And I'll say, no, 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 not all cops are bad. Just like not all white people are bad. Not all black people are bad. Not all anybody is bad. You have good and bad in everyone. And so teaching him how to advocate, teaching him how to use his words effectively, but also challenging his thought process and having him to do his best to think through everything and not just assume that you would absolutely do this or that if this were you and this were, if you were in this situation, because you don't understand how paralyzed maybe those people felt in that moment because of their previous experiences, because of not being able, not seeing justice. So, you know, maybe they would have lost their lives had they intervened. You know, so it's just, it's a constant conversation. It is a constant conversation with my son, and I teach him to analyze everything. Don't just assume everything, analyze every situation. And, you know, and I would tell him, listen, do you want me to go there and talk? No, 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 mom, I'll handle it. I'll handle it. And I would always say to him, I'm going to handle it in my head. I'm like, I'm going to handle it anyway, but I want to give you a chance to advocate because you need to know that in your future, not just in racially motivated situations, but in every area of life, you need to know that you first have to start standing up for yourself, because if you can't self-advocate, you can't advocate for anybody. So that's something that I constantly work with him on.
And, you know, there was only one, like one black teacher, like in the whole elementary school system in this town. I mean, and now there's none, none. And it is just really difficult to have children in the school setting dealing with things that come up, different racial slurs that are spewed or written anywhere, things that happen now on social media that spills over into school. Those are things that happen as well. It's very difficult. They do not feel that they have an ally. So the safe space that, you know, many schools say that they provide for these children, it's really not there. There's so many children that have voiced it. They were able to say, let the school know that we don't feel like we have a voice and that we ever are heard.
And Allie, you've been going through that with Chelsea.
Yeah, I have. Actually, I have her right here, as a matter of fact. I want to put her on so she can kind of say a few things.
Yeah, let's have Chelsea jump on.
Hi.
Hi, Chelsea. Are you surprised by what's going on in our world right now?
What's happening right now is not like new or surprising to me. And I feel like that's also the case to a lot of like my contemporaries, I would say, because a few years ago when Ferguson was happening, there was a lot of people vocally online, like decrying, like, you know, these injustices. And there was a lot of backlash. And this is like, and this was a long time coming. There's been so many like just senseless murders and just acts of violence from law enforcement to regular citizens, and completely unwarranted all the time, that this isn't like, it's not surprising to me that it's gotten to this point where finally like people are so fed up with like their material conditions about like everything that's going on within like our, you know, the socioeconomic status of like this entire nation, that people are out in the streets in every 50 states and in various countries all over the world talking about what's going on and, you know, trying to have these conversations where they're, they're exposing every facet of racism, which is not just interpersonal things where somebody's calling you a mean name or somebody's, you know, discriminating you based on your color, but it's also the systemic things that are set into place where it's Black people aren't given the same opportunities to go get a loan to buy a house, or not, you know, given the abilities to go to certain school districts where they're go to certain schools where they get the property tax money to fund the school. So they're stuck, you know, under resourced in the first place. There's a lot of things to be done. There's a lot of work to be done. It's very important that people like take this time to address, you know, not just what goes on and how they treat people, their interpersonal actions, but in the institutions that they're a part of, how do they reinforce racism and how can they combat that? So like one of the things my mom was saying like last night was talking about, like, you know, these companies that say, let's say we stand with Black lives and we value like contributions of Black people. All right. So in your, at the corporate and executive level, how many Black people do you have employed? Mm-hmm. Are you giving people jobs? Or like another conversation we had earlier today is that like with friends of mine is that like universities, they say like, oh, we stand with Black, with our Black students. Okay. But are you supporting Black student groups and our efforts to, you know, celebrate ourselves and be safe on your campus? Are you providing like financial aid and resources to Black students so that they're actually getting resources? Like, it's not enough just to say it. It's good to say it. Right. It's good to acknowledge it. But here's how we need to take it a step forward. I just especially encourage people to not just have the conversations, but also to have to do the reading.
Right.
To do the research on these different types of topics and to get an understanding of like, oh, maybe this is something we can do. Maybe this is something I can contact my local legislators about. Maybe this is something I can contact the people at my workplace about.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Thank you so much. That was awesome, Chelsea.
Thanks for jumping on just to like hear your perspective. When I think about all the parents who are listening to our conversation here, I know many of them are wondering, what can we do to make sure that our children value and appreciate people of other races and cultures? Do you have any advice? Let's start with you, Charlene.
We're in a day and age where a lot of parents are just like picking up on like, no conversation, no face-to-face conversation. Everything is text. You know, I had one parent do a video and then they text me the video of her talking. Still avoidance of communicating with me. And you know what I mean? Avoidance of human contact. I think the biggest thing is get to know the children's parents. Get to know them. Make that effort to get to know them. When I did that, I made such great connections. And they were able to see and learn about me and my background growing up and how much we had in common, you know? So that's what I would really, like, don't just shoot text messages or, you know, like, actually have a conversation. Get to know the parents. And then that way you'll be able to see how much we really have in common.
I like that.
I can honestly say that the parents that Jaden is friends with and Charlene's daughter's youngest daughter is friends with, all we know all these parents. My son is allowed in their house and their children are allowed in my house. Because that to me is a true test. If your child is allowed in my house, then I know you're really okay with this relationship. But if every interaction we have is my son going to your house, that I'm a little concerned about how you feel about me. You might accept my kid for the sake of your kid having a friend, but do you accept all of him? And so I can honestly say that, you know, in his situation, which I'm thankful for, but it does take the parents being on top of it. I am very adamant about where my child goes and who he's around at all times.
What do you guys think it's going to take to truly affect change, you know, in our country, to where we can be reconciled and there can be an end to racism and its effects? What do you guys think about that? Let's start with you, Allie.
We're all looking for solutions to a problem that we're still hurting from. We get it that all lives matter, but all lives can't matter until Black lives matter. I think we need to start treating racists almost like, as if you treat a terrorist. I mean, because we're Americans and we're here on American soil. I mean, start looking at them and saying, this is terrorism. People have been saying, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? And I feel that what can be done, maybe it has to become a thing where it's illegal to treat a person a certain way. I just feel like laws and even on a local level, county level, all the people walking up and down, like, yes, this is great, but how are you going to really affect actual change if laws aren't made to enforce it? People have to know that you can't get away with it, because kids are going to do what they can get away with. People are going to do what they can get away with.
Along the lines of what Allie said about it being against the law, but maybe not to that level. I do feel that it should be flagged when there's been, it's like folks have been found to be acting out in a racist manner, and it goes to a level where police involvement or school, like, on the school records type of thing. I do feel that it should be like flagged when they go to seek employment to a certain degree, depending on the population they're serving, because that's what happened in these systems. These learned behaviors kept getting, reincarnated generation after generation after generation. And those that are leading these agencies that are, working one-on-one with specific, demographics, are the ones that are making decisions and never lived a day in life in their shoes and making prejudgments. So I really do feel that it should be some real consequences to it, that it affects what your character looks like, and it affects possibly your money and your job and your lifestyle. And maybe that's when the change will really begin.
I don't think there will be an end to racism, because we are flawed and we are sinful people. So I don't think there, and even if we end disliking or hating each other based on our color, it may look like we dislike or hate each other based on status only or socioeconomic. There will always be some group or some reason to hate someone. So even though it will be wonderful for racism to end, it will not end. But I think that I'm not pessimistic to say nothing can happen. I'm just realistic and say that, it will end when our king returns. That's when it will end. But in our might, I don't think it will end. But I think what we can do is to begin, what this process of what's been going on, of people being more empathetic, people being exposed as well, not just looking at the side of empathy, looking to expose situations. Things need, sure. There needs to be a light shun on hatred, period. There needs to be a light shone on the economic and health disparities and challenge those things. There needs to be a light shone on every aspect where people are being oppressed. That's human trafficking, that's financially, that's health-wise. I mean, that's, racial barriers. I mean, there's so many different areas. I think things have to be exposed, because you can't deal with something that is hidden. And so I think these conversations, and not just conversations and protests, but actual plans of action. And, saying to each person in each community, or even on a block, you don't necessarily have to make a macro change. You can start where you are in your microcosm. And I think one of the goals should be, first and foremost, to me, because I'm always looking at it from a biblical lens, like I said, things happen in the natural, but it has a spiritual impact. So I look at it biblically and I'm saying, okay, if God wants his kingdom agenda to be manifested, how do we promote the kingdom? Not that you have to be on the corner with your Bible saying, hey, be a holy roller, but there are ways to spread the kingdom of God and to impact, you can do it through your example. Let your walk be kingdom minded. You know, look to serve those who are in need, who are food insecure, who are home insecure, who are clothing insecure. This is how you impart change. You know, if I see a homeless man on the street and that homeless man is Caucasian and he may have never had a positive interaction with somebody of a different race, well, I'm going to feed that man. I don't know what his interactions have been, but it starts there. You know, if I see a black brother or sister in a situation that where they're in need, or maybe even they're in an argument, you know, a black young boy or a black young girl or what have you is cursing their black brother and sister out. You know, I can't say, oh, don't talk to these kids. You never know. These kids carry guns and you never know. They might pop off at you. I can't be afraid of that. I have to speak to them in love and say, hey, you don't need to do that. Let me show you another way. If they're willing to listen, but you can't just walk away from stuff.
Allie, what role do you think the church has to play in this reconciliation process?
Now, the church has to rise up and change the way they're doing things, because the church hurt that goes back to slavery times. Because remember, the slave masters were using the Bible to control the slaves and came to Africa on the pretense of spreading the gospel, but did not do that. So that healing has to begin there. It really has to begin, and it is starting. They're starting to, you know, it's starting to begin there, the healing, so the forgiveness and all that has to happen. But on that one end, and that's on the spiritual side, you know, and the prayer side is the really the spiritual side, right? And then we have the biblical side, the spiritual side, but then we have right in the real law to actually have people of God to stand in the gap and go out there and say, you know, whatever you do for the least of my people, you do for me. And you go out there and you make these laws stick so that it's not okay for you to shoot someone jogging if they're black.
And Allie, I think I'm sorry, Debbie. I just wanted to just say something really quick to Allie's point about slavery. I think that's also something that needs to change in our educational system, because not everyone who is here in this country was brought on a slave ship. Not everyone's ancestors were brought on a slave ship. My mother's side of the family were not slaves. And I don't say that to be pompous, but that's not everyone's narrative. You know, my father's relatives, they were brought here, but they were brought to Trinidad. So I think it's when our kids learn history in school, that is the only narrative they are taught, that we came from slaves, we descended here from slaves. And so it creates subliminally an immediate inferiority complex. They're not taught that they came from great nations and kings and chiefs and things like that. Yeah. They're initially taught, and not just them taught, because, you know, their white children are in this same classroom getting this same education. And so I think that being the only narrative is a problem.
Yeah. Everyone's indoctrinated.
Right.
Into a system, exactly. Black or white, whatever color,
exactly.
Or Chinese or Indian, whatever your race is, you're being taught this about black people in your country.
Exactly. And I think that that is a major problem, because, you know, you start learning this thing and before you know it, you're not even realizing that this is how you are identifying yourself.
Yes.
And so that narrative needs to change. It starts when they're first educated. They have to be school system, everything is a system. And the educational system is just as responsible as the legal system.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so true. Yep. You know, coming from the white community's perspective, what I wanted to say is that I think that that the white community needs to take more proactive steps in getting to know the black community, in building relationships, in, you know, making more interpersonal friendships, not just like a, hey, how's it going? You know, you're seeing that hashtag a lot now, like be the bridge builder, you know, building bridges. That to me is like really what needs to happen, especially because you cannot empathize with people that you don't know. When you get to know people though, on a personal level, there's going to be a greater depth of empathy because you're going to be more connected to them. People need to get to know each other, and people also need to get uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think white people have not gotten uncomfortable.
And don't discount what people are trying to share with you, their life experiences.
Yes.
Don't say like, make it feel like it's just in their head. Like that's the biggest thing I would want to drive home.
Yeah.
Like, stop discounting the experience of Black people.
Or trying to compare it to some struggle a white person has been through.
Right.
Yeah.
I had someone do that actually today. I had someone do that to me today, as a matter of fact. And they gave an example of something they'd gone through. And I was like, okay. Mm-hmm, but I think you're right about people who are going to have to be uncomfortable, because we're dealing with, as you said, sin. We're dealing with sin, because racism, it is sin. Even if it's natural, it's sin.
Yeah.
And when we're dealing with the world, you got to expect the world to behave like the world does.
Yeah.
So you're not going to be able to, if you can't even control people in the church, how do you think you're going to control the people outside of the church? You can't control them, but you can give them boundaries with, and I keep going back to the legal aspect, give them boundaries through legislation. In the church, you can teach that building of the bridge. I think that's how we're going to heal in the church. That I think, I really feel in the church, the bridge building is going to be more effective in the church than it would be outside of the church.
Well, the thing is, there's a lot of non-denominational churches and teaching and following, huge following, and they're doing a great job, the best that they can on, you know, under the comfort level that they're comfortable with doing, the pastors and leaders. However, there's also the other, in the same breath, there's still there's the times when things like this happen and they're silent. And so the silence is what hurts even more.
Yeah.
Than them actually going out there and acting on it. Like, you know, the silence is piercing. And it's heavy. Silence is heavy in many ways. Through therapy, you be silent and you allow your client to talk.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very heavy and it's very necessary, the silence. But then in the same breath, when that silence is flipped in a scenario or situation such as these that have been occurring years after years after years, and they'll talk about the looting and they'll talk about all these different things that are going on, but wait, hold on. You didn't say nothing about what just happened. You see, we both have the eyes and we both saw this. Like, that didn't move you enough to speak? So that's the thing, too, that really gets to me.
When we look at our past, our history in the 60s, like when we look at the 60s when they were marching in Selma and the boycotts and everything like that, there were, of course, there were plenty of racist white people, but there were also white people who stood in solidarity with us. But the common theme of those white people who stood in solidarity and the Black people who were marching and fighting, they were both groups were willing to lose. And what they were facing losing were their lives. And they both felt that it was just, I mean, granted, the amount of people that were marching who were white versus Black was, the numbers were disproportionate, but at the same time, they were unified in that mission that this was wrong. And many of them died. You know, not all of them were reported being killed, but many of them had to risk losing their family relations because they were going to be called a nigger lover. You know, many of them crossed barriers and were willing to lose. And I think that our white brothers and sisters, as well as our Black brothers and sisters, have to remember that. It is going to cost you. It may cost you friendships. It may cost you your job. It may cost you a lot of things. But if you're not willing to be discomfortable, to sit in discomfort now, you will at some point have to sit in it. And it may not face you in the same way you're denying it, but it may be brought to your children. And you may still have to deal with discomfort in one way, shape, or another. So I think we need to reflect back on what was. And people were willing to pay the price for a cause that they felt was that important. We're not willing to lose in this day and age. So much gain has happened. You know, people have gotten more money. They can live, so, you know, quote unquote, where they want to live. And things have gotten so comfortable, even in letting things slide. If it doesn't necessarily impact you, you know, you'll share it on Facebook, you know, hey, pass this along and I've done my part. Nobody's willing to lose anything. And we have to be willing to lose.
Right. And something else too that I've noticed, especially on social media, is that like everything is so political. I mean, of course, like we're dealing with such division in our country right now, but also like the whole political thing is so charged right now that people I've noticed too. You know, I think I've seen many posts where people have actually said, you know, like where they've actually posted videos like. And you know, and I'm talking about white friends that they've said, you know what, I just got to come on here and do this video because I need to speak up about this. And the reason why they weren't speaking up before was because they were afraid that it was going to reflect poorly politically, that somehow we have tied up racism with politics. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, right. Since when do politics define righteousness and what is right and what is wrong? And we have to stop identifying one side of the party as being righteous and one side as being unrighteous too. I mean, at the end of the day, it's about standing up for what is right.
Right.
That's right. That's
you
right.
Know? Exactly.
Good.
Be not conformed to the image of this world. You know, when I look at the methods and the tactics of the enemy, his whole purpose and goal is to kill, steal, and destroy. He has no color agenda. He wants to take everybody out. And I think of when you look at horror flicks, I'm not a horror flick fan, but when you see, you know, the silly teenagers, they're all together and then they make a stupid decision to go their separate ways, and then they get picked off one by one. And so I'm looking at this whole situation like a horror flick. You know, where there is division, there's conquering. And so I think it's, you know, my heart's desire is for unity. The Bible says that, you know, many, you know, the body has many members. You know, we are the body. We are supposed to be the body. Whether we are a black part of the body, a white part of the body, an Asian part of the body, whatever. When there is division, you're picked off. Period. There's separation. There's conquering. And so it's my hope. I'm not saying we're going to end racism, but it's my hope that those of us who have an understanding of love, have an understanding of Christ, have an understanding to, first of all, what it's like to be, you know, saved, for us to be unified, and then also to spread that love outside to those who are not. There has to be unity somewhere. We need unity in the Black community. We need unity as a nation. You know, even in the white community, there's white people who are at odds with each other. There needs to be unity. You know, it doesn't matter. Like, when you are divided, that is the perfect, even in couples and marriages and marital households, if a husband and wife are not on the same page, the enemy creeps in. So, you know, that's just how I view this whole thing. There must be some sort of unification at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Matthew 12:22, a house divided cannot stand.
A house divided cannot stand. I can't think of a better truth to end on. President Lincoln quoted this Bible verse himself in a speech over 150 years ago in regards to the conflict over slavery. Looking at the conflicts within our country today, how do we close the gap of division? I believe we need to quiet ourselves and listen to the stories of those in the Black community so that we can truly empathize and then heal.
We need to be bridge builders. I highly recommend BeTheBridge.com as a great resource for helping you do that. I'd also love for you to keep this conversation going by sharing this podcast with others through email and social media. Please subscribe to Not By Sight with Deborah Stewart wherever you choose to listen to your podcasts. And I'd love to hear from you. You can email me at notbysightpodcast@gmail.com and join the conversation on Facebook on our group page, Not By Sight Podcast. Thanks for listening. Take care.